Hey, how's the weather?
That's on everybody's mind. How about one word? Icy.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's Mike July. He worked for the National Weather Service for the last 24 years, and he developed a bit of a following in Kansas City for witty social media posts he wrote about the weather because, let's face it, the weather here often feels like a joke. Like yesterday, for example, when the temperature dropped something like 20 degrees in 10 minutes or something crazy like that. Mike's just retired from his post as senior forecaster, so today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll look back on his storied career tracking Kansas City's manic weather patterns. Thanks for being here, Mike.
Thank you, Gina, for having me.
Do you think it's fair to call our weather manic? I'm not sure if you can really give weather a clinical diagnosis, but I mean, yesterday it was in the 60s and now we're approaching a winter storm.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I kind of equate our weather here in Kansas City. One day it's 65, next day it's, you know, you're looking at possible ice storm.
Are you from Kansas City?
No, I grew up in northern Illinois, so I'm from a small town, LaSalle. It's about 10,000 people and spent my first 20 years there.
How did you get interested in weather initially? I mean, were you very young when you started thinking more than the average person about the weather?
Yeah, I was kind of geeky, I guess, back then when I was a little kid. For some reason, I had a fascination with watching the weather guy on TV, and so I used to pretend I was that guy. I had an actual map of the United States, and I'd take a watercolor type pen, and I'd draw fronts on it, and I'd close my door so nobody could see me, and I'd kind of pretend I was doing the weather forecast. So I kind of did that probably when I was about 8 or 9 years old.
What was your favorite kind of weather to pretend forecast?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. I kind of did them all. I just kind of just talked about fronts and things like that. But I've always had a fascination with severe weather like tornadoes and things like that.
How did you end up pursuing that interest? Was it informal at first, or did you just kind of gravitate toward it academically?
I think it's a little bit of a combination of that. Kind of had an interest in the back of my mind when I was growing up, and I loved playing baseball and did that all the way through junior college. And then when I finally realized that there's no major league career for me there, I decided, I think maybe doing the weather might be interesting, and it's turned out to be a very rewarding experience.
What's rewarding about it?
It's different every day. I think a lot of people can say that their job is maybe mundane. It's the same routine day in and day out. But in weather, like we talked about just a few seconds ago, one day it's 65, the next day it's 25, maybe snowing. And there's always a challenge. I love challenges. And I think that has a lot of interest to me, is always being faced with a challenge.
Was it the job at the National Weather Service that brought you to Kansas City?
Yes, it was. I started out first in the private sector doing things like I'm doing right now. I was doing on-air radio and TV for the first couple of years in the private sector. And then I was fortunate enough that one of the guys I went to school with was working here in Kansas City for the National Severe Storms Forecast Center. Said there was a job here, and I've always wanted to get into the National Weather Service, so I applied for it, and I was fortunate enough to get that job here in Kansas City back in December of 1983.
Your job is kind of to predict the future, which is, I mean, I guess economists do that too. But, I mean, how do you do that? I understand how someone who knows a lot about the weather might be able to analyze what's happening in the present, but how do you predict what's going to happen tomorrow down to, like, at this point, the expectation is probably less than an hour-by-hour breakdown?
Right. It's a combination of, there's a lot of art involved. It's not just looking at computer output, because back in the early to mid 80s, the computers were a big part of it, but there was a lot of art, a lot of learning from the guy in front of you. I had a lot of mentors that kind of passed along what they learned.
And when you say a lot of art, what do you mean?
Well, I don't mean getting crayons and drawing on a piece of paper, but it's kind of like that. We would get the information, the data, and we would get weather maps. We would plot the weather maps. We would analyze it and then kind of compare it to past studies. And that's what we're kind of doing with this ice storm, potential ice storm that's coming in, is we're comparing what we're seeing to what's happened in the past.
Does it ever happen that what really happens is just a total aberration and has no resemblance to anything that's happened in the past?
That can happen because our data that we have only goes back a finite amount of time. And as we know, the Earth has been here quite a long time, a lot longer than we've been here. So, yeah, there's times that things happen that have never happened before and we don't have anything to go by. But again, the computer model is becoming more and more sophisticated, and they're helping us out a lot.
I want to get back to some of that later, but you moved to Kansas City for this job, and Kansas City's weather actually turns out, sort of in an unscientific study, I would say, to be one of the reasons people move away. That's kind of according to this series of stories that we did about why people move here and why people leave. And the weather came up a lot as one of the reasons people leave. I think you might be the first person who came here for the weather who I have talked to.
I think if you talk to a lot of the forecasters that live here in Kansas City, they love the weather here because it's so diverse. You don't get stuck with, a lot of people like sunny and 85 in San Diego every day, but other people like variations. Like on Facebook, we get a lot of people that love snow. You know, we had the snowbirds, but then you get a lot of people chiming in and says, well, you can move then because I don't want the snow here. You can go live up north. But there's a lot of give and take with that.
What were your first impressions of Kansas City?
Big. I grew up in a small town, and so coming here, it was big. And I can say with beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's some of the most friendly, outgoing people that I've been around. And that's why my wife and I have made this our home. The original plan was to live here for about 3 or 4 years. And then my wife said, maybe we ought to, move back to Illinois, back to home, back to our family. But it just didn't work out. And as time went on, he just kind of fell in love with the area, the people.
And this ended up being home?
This is home.
What's the most memorable weather event you've tracked in your time here? I mean, can you pick one?
Well, two of them, one that many of us have lived through, and that was the ice storm back in January 29th through 31st back in 2002. And then the May 4th, 2003 tornado that went through Kansas City. That was very memorable because on that day our family was out in Basar playing in a baseball tournament. And
lots of baseball in your family.
Lots of baseball. My two youngest sons, both sons have played baseball. One is still playing baseball in high school. And then my daughter plays competitive softball. And so I was involved with that quite a bit. But that particular day, we saw the storms coming. I told everybody, you need to get off the field, you need to head home. And
so you were a civilian-turned-weather guy?
Yeah, I always kind of wore two hats, a baseball hat and a weatherman's hat.
So you really, like, in the middle of the game, were like, okay, you guys, this is serious. I'm looking at the sky. This isn't going to be a joke. Like, let's get out of here.
Well, I kind of knew ahead of time because we were preparing a day or two in advance, the office was, for this particular event, that the potential was there for bad storms. So I knew going out that day that, yeah, we could have some bad storms in the afternoon. And then when we saw this area down to our southwest coming towards us, and I had called the office and I said, we need to get out of here.
Are there, given what is coming up this weekend, are there especially memorable snow or ice storms that most of us on the other side of the weather would we would all remember, but probably remember from a really different vantage point than you?
Well, I can recall a time when I kind of goofed up. We were traveling back from Illinois, I said, we'll take the I-80 route, come down through I-29 because the storm will miss us. And I zigged when I should have zagged. I kind of goofed up, and we got hit with the bad part of the storm. So that was, it was back in the late 90s, I believe.
It's funny to me that your most memorable weather events happened, it sounds like, when you were not in the office. I mean, they happened to you the way they actually happened to all of us as a person caught in a storm.
Yeah, it kind of seems that way, but I've had my fair share of being in the office when all heck is breaking loose with tornadic storms and having to sit in front of the screen and putting out tornado warnings, being the radar operator. I've been through that. So it's, the most memorable one seems to be that, yeah.
The snow, I'm remembering, I think it was about 2002. I could be wrong on that. The early 2000s, though, that there was an ice storm that covered all of the leaves and branches on trees in ice, and the branches were breaking. And if you would drive down the street, which was not a good idea, but some like you had to sometimes, you would hear just crackling in the sky. And
you're right on the date. Anyway, it was in 2002, late January. Yeah, and I was home for that one too. Although I did have to drive in to work for a couple of those days. But yeah, we didn't have any power for 3 days, like many of the people at that time. I think it was over 400,000 people without power in Kansas City at one time during that event. And there was 1 to 2 inches of ice. And with there being silence in the house, you could hear the branches crackling. We had huge tree limbs falling down like everybody else. And that was memorable. Didn't want to do that again, though.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned tornadoes. I know you come from Illinois, so that was probably nothing new to you.
It's not as big of a deal there because we don't get it quite as often. It's more hailstorms there, but the further west you go and the further south you go, the frequency of tornadoes increase.
Something that you said earlier about the art of predicting what's going to happen with the weather, like the idea that, you use your computers, but there is an element of art to it. Can you give me an example of a weather event that required more than just a computer to predict?
Ooh, boy, now you're taxing my long and short-term memory, which is failing me.
Sorry.
But there was, I can recall back when I worked at downtown Kansas City in the severe storms forecast office, putting together the outlook of severe weather for the following day, and using my previous experience and again my mentors kind of guiding me, coming up with a forecast that basically the computer wasn't coming up with, and depicting an area where there could be an outbreak of severe storms.
What is it that a human being can perceive about weather that a computer can't?
Unfortunately, I think as we get further down the line here, we're depending more and more on computers and not letting our brains do a lot of the work. Our brains can handle more abstract ideas than the computer, which is a yes or no type of solution. So I think if we got to, you know, allow the forecasters to have the ability to use their brain cells, if you will, to kind of look at things. But
what is abstract about the weather? Because as a person who weather just happens to, I mean, I don't predict weather. And I often, in fact, I should check the forecasts more than I do. Weather comes as generally a bit of a surprise to me, unless people are really talking about something that's going to happen. But for me, it is kind of a yes or no type thing, like it did or didn't rain. What is abstract about it?
Good question. I think unless you actually sit in that chair and put the forecast together, you don't have a good understanding of that. It's like kind of like my wife, she wants a yes or no. Is it going to rain? I don't want to know 30%, 50%. It's a yes or no. And I says, well, it's a little bit more than that, you know. And so also you're couching your words. So you're kind of guarded. I says, well, kind of, yeah.
I love your dinner time conversation.
Oh, well, yeah. My wife has some interesting conversations with me about the weather, especially if I don't have a yes or no answer for her.
Well, when KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear how Mike July of the National Weather Service gave Kansas City's weather a following on social media. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Mike July, who was a senior forecaster with the National Weather Service until his recent retirement. Hi again, Mike.
Hi, Gina.
So we've been talking a little bit about computers, but I want to ask you more broadly how the technology of weather forecasting has changed in the 24 years you've been in Kansas City.
Well, initially, as we touched on earlier, a lot of it had to do with kind of an art form, if you will, combined with computers. And the computers have become more and more sophisticated as they've, as the educators have developed them better. And so now, instead of you know, a three-day forecast that was, let's say, 80% accurate, now they can go out to 5 or 6 days and have close to that kind of same accuracy. So we're actually extending the time frame of being more accurate.
What can computers do now that they couldn't do, I mean, 24, 25 years ago?
I think it has to do with the processing of data. It's so much faster technology. I mean, it's just amazing. Unfortunately, I'm not a computer programmer, so I don't know all that goes, the ins and outs. I just see what it spits out. But a lot of it has to do with the amount of information that a computer can handle and process, which is faster than the human brain. But again, it's more of a yes or no type decision.
There's something of an irony here at this radio station that the people who tell our listeners what the weather is up to are doing so from an indoor studio without windows. Does your work happen indoors, or do you sometimes like go actually look at the sky?
Oh yeah, we head outdoors to make sure that what we're telling people is actually occurring out there. We do have windows in the office, but yeah, there's times you go outside and maybe there's a big storm headed your way, and hey, I want to get a bird's eye view of it. Yeah, we head outdoors.
Do you use like binoculars?
No, just the naked eye and kind of take a scan out there and kind of get a good view of it.
I mean, do you think that weather people are generally outdoorsy people or kind of homebodies? I mean, does studying the weather and being interested in weather make you want to go outside, or does it make you want to hide?
That's an excellent question, Gina. I think most forecasters, weather people, have this fascination with the weather. And they want to be outdoors. They want to see it. We have a number of forecasters down in Pleasant Hill and others that I've worked with over the years that want to go out and chase storms and study them. And so, yeah, we want to be outdoors.
Talking about the weather can be synonymous with idle or even just straight up boring kind of chit-chat. Could you make the case for weather being interesting?
Try. Because it can be a very dry subject, especially when you're talking to somebody, a scientist, where a lot of jargon gets thrown out there and they don't talk to you on a one-to-one level. Yeah, it can be kind of difficult at times trying to get the information from us to the general public.
But so what is interesting, not even just about weather reports, but about weather as a phenomenon?
I think it's just the sheer awness, the beauty of nature. I am just so fascinated with how storms form and what can happen as a storm develops. The beauty, and it can be somewhat scary. Sometimes we get accused of being overwarning, if you will, but just the sheer beauty and the awesomeness of nature.
Did Twitter give you an outlet to connect with people about this awesome force in your life in a way that you hadn't been able to do before?
I think the Weather Service, I'm thinking about 7 or 8 years ago, decided that, yeah, we need to get involved in social media. And so our office, the office I used to work at down in Pleasant Hill, was at the forefront of this and continues to be at the forefront of social media. And so we've got a large presence on Facebook and on Twitter, and it continues to grow to this very day. And people depend on it now more and more than what we did before. And so this is a better outlet for us now.
But you have a reputation for your witty your witty tweets.
But don't ask my kids about that, because anytime I say what I think is kind of witty, they just kind of roll their eyes. Yeah, I kind of got involved in that. All of the forecasters are involved with that down in Pleasant Hill. And I kind of went kicking and screaming doing it initially, because I was kind of old-timer and stuck in the mud kind of thing. And I thought, I don't know if I buy this. But I kind of got talked into it, and it just kind of blossomed from there. And a couple of the other forecasters that were deep into social media, they kind of show me the way.
Is there a tweet that you masterminded that you are especially proud of?
Oh, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I know I used to talk about oak mites all the time when they started attacking me, and I decided, well, this is one way to kind of have a link to others out there, because everybody else is having the same problem. and just kind of relate my own experiences weather-wise and as to how that's affecting me and how it affects others. And kind of like with the cold weather, I'll talk about how, get your kiddos bundled up because, if you got a high schooler or a teenager, how difficult that can be. They're out there 20 degrees below zero in shorts and short sleeves.
So, I mean, weather is one of those very few things that actually does affect everyone. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're tapping into there. I wonder, we are going into a weekend where there are some dire predictions storm-wise. What can you tell us about, I know you're retired, but what can you tell us about what to expect this weekend?
Well, it happens to be affecting me personally. And you can't really take your weather hat off once you retire. It's kind of ingrained. I think anybody that it's been a profession a long time, you just don't drop dead and move on to something else. You're still kind of tied into it. But my daughter's going to be traveling out of St. Louis Friday night. And so she's been after me and, hey, what's the weather going to be? And what time can I leave? And is it going to have flight delays? So I'm trying to figure out, will the airport shut down and things like that?
What do you think is the answer to that?
That's a $64,000 question, and I hope I get it right. But I think that from what I've seen and looked at, we're in for some very icy weather. There's some similarities, not saying it's going to happen, but similarities of 2002.
Oh, yikes. The one we were just talking about.
The one we were just talking about, there's some similarities to it.
What are the similarities?
The amount of ice. We could be seeing a half an inch of ice.
But how do you know?
Going back to computer models, looked at some of those, and then I looked at some comparisons to previous cases, and there's the 2002 event was number two on the list. So there's some similarities there. Because it's also over a number of days where it's going to start icing up tomorrow afternoon and then probably shut down a little bit on Saturday. And then the worst part of the storm is likely to come in late Saturday afternoon through the overnight hours of Saturday. And so if you're going to be traveling outside this time, probably don't do it unless it's an emergency.
Oy. So should people be also like stocking up on provisions and things? Because the storm that we were comparing it to, people lost power, as you said.
Right. That's probably a good idea. But, once we say something like that, then everybody heads out to the grocery stores and there's toilet paper's gone. There's no milk. There's no bread.
And you've got long lines to deal with, Mike July.
Yes, I do have long lines. And so I'd say, don't get crazy and don't get scared about it, but just be prepared.
Do people often ask you to predict the weather now that you're retired, just kind of like I did?
Yeah. I haven't had anything recently, but, I'll have neighbors saying, what's the weather going to be? And mostly from family, but occasionally some neighbors will ask.
What will you be doing during retirement other than informally providing weather reports to friends and neighbors?
That's an excellent question and something I battled with for the better part of a year or so. I think once my son stops playing baseball, I'm probably going to become an umpire. I think I'll probably take a shot at that. My kids last year said, oh, you ought to be an umpire. I ought to be an umpire. I says, I don't know if I want to do that.
But wait, why did your kids say that? Are you doing that sort of I think they want like to get casually me out from the stands?
I think they, well, yeah, I think you could say that. Attending games, my wife wouldn't want to sit around me very long because I'd be saying this, that, and the other. I can't enjoy the game. Just be quiet. Just watch the game. That's part of it is that. Maybe the kids and my wife want to get me out of the house. I don't know.
Well, Mike July, senior forecaster with the National Weather Service here in Kansas City, enjoy your retirement, and I hope the lines aren't too long at the store when you go to get your toilet paper later.
Thanks, Gina.
Up next, Martin Luther King gave a surprising speech at K-State in Manhattan, Kansas, in 1968. We'll hear about the impression it left on Kansans who heard it. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Now we're going to look back on Martin Luther King Jr.'s last major stop in Kansas. That was in 1968, the year he was assassinated. Our friends at The Archiver, a Kansas history podcast, recently dug up the audio from that visit. Here's The Archiver, hosted by KCUR's Sam Zeff and made possible by a grant from the Kansas Humanities Council.
CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee, after being shot in the face by an unknown assailant on the balcony in front of a downtown hotel a short while ago. Associated Press says Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux of Memphis confirmed Dr. King's death. Reverend Dr. King, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to lead demonstrations in sympathy with a prolonged strike by municipal garbage men, most of them Negro. Police at last report were still looking for a young white male who was seen running from the scene of the shooting and reportedly dropped.
For most, 1968 would feel like the United States was coming apart at the seams. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam, wild political conventions, and assassinations. First Dr. King, then Senator Robert Kennedy. Both great men would have ties to Kansas in 1968. Kennedy, as we talked about on a previous Archiver, gave his first speech in Kansas after he announced his presidential run. King would start his year at Kansas State University on January 19th at convocation at a jam-packed Ahern Fieldhouse. King came away impressed and heartened by the students he met that day in Manhattan. But we didn't know how impressed until decades later when handwritten notes found in the suit jacket he was wearing the night he was shot surfaced. Notes directly tied to Kansas State. And his words that cold morning in Manhattan are as meaningful today as they were 48 years ago.
You see, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction. But truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it's a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. And if I stop at this point, I'm afraid I would leave you the victims of an illusion wrapped in superficiality. And we will all go away the victims of a dangerous optimism. And so in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and not only talk about the problem in terms of the progress that we have made, but also make it clear that we still have a long, long way to go before the problem of racial injustice is solved.
The podcast is Archiver. The episode, Dr. King's Last College Stop, me. I'm your host, Sam Zeff. King, of course, was right. There was, and is, a long, long way to go before racial injustice is solved. I'll play you more from his speech in just a little bit, but for many Kansans looking back, it may seem odd that this most prominent civil rights leader would find his way to a college convocation in the middle of Kansas.
Well, somewhat surprisingly, I think, for those of us from the eastern part of the state, and Lawrence in particular, is the fact that you find that Manhattan was very much in the same melee of social unrest and political consciousness during that period of time.
If you don't know him, that's Archiver historian Virgil Dean.
I think comparing the two situations, it would be very similar. Throughout the 60s, you have, particularly in the late 60s, you have protests on campus, especially having to do with women's rights, women students demanding more equality, the right to participate in athletics and that kind of thing. Civil rights movement are certainly playing a prominent role. And, of course, Vietnam leads to a lot of campus unrest and the social turmoil of that day, to the point where in late 1968, in December, there's an arson fire that ultimately burns down Nichols Hall, which was the gymnasium at the time, and it's attributed to anti-war involvement. Not that it was, affected every student or that you had massive numbers of people turning out to all of these protests or demonstrations or that they were even all that common, but certainly they were not uncommon, and there were lots of different groups involved. K-State before this time, had formed a Students for Democratic Society, SDS, organization. So they'd been involved in this, just like college students throughout the state and the nation, for a number of years by the time Martin Luther King arrived.
Now, King didn't arrive at K-State without concern for his safety or controversy. The president at the time, James McCain, was criticized for bringing such a radical to the KSU campus. The man who arranged the lecture, Political Science Department Chair William Boyer, received a threatening letter that he turned over to the FBI. So King's speech was part lecture, part sermon. The first part was laden with facts and figures on poverty, unemployment, and education. But then King transitioned from lecture to sermon. He didn't have a speech, really, just notes. A King aide said the K-State speech was homiletics, the art of preaching. This is about midway through, and he just got done talking about nonviolent change.
But after saying this, I must say that it would be an act of moral irresponsibility for me to condemn riots and not be as vigorous in condemning the continued existence of intolerable conditions in our society which cause people to feel so angry and bitter. They conclude they have no alternative to get attention and to engage in this kind of violence. What we must see is that a riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It's failed to hear that the promises of freedom and equality have not been met. It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, humanity, and equality. And so it is still true that our nation summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as justice is postponed, we will be on the verge of social disruption.
As long as justice is postponed, we will be on the verge of social disruption. That was certainly true in 1968, but is it true today? We'll tackle that question in a bit, but first, let's listen to a little more of King's speech and hear from someone who was in Ahern Fieldhouse that day. King had just finished talking about his opposition to the Vietnam War, something that made him even more unpopular among white conservatives. But then his mood perked.
Now, I must admit, there are times that I get rather discouraged in the midst of setbacks, in the midst of what I see as the constant vacillations and ambivalences of American white society. And there are times that some of us begin to wonder whether this problem can be solved. But ever and again, I get out and I get around the colleges and universities of our country, and I get to talk with many of the young people, and I must honestly say to you that my hope is always renewed in those settings. I think that you who sit today under the sound of my voice may well have the answer. For it's the student generation that's saying to America that there must be a radical reordering of priorities. It's the student generation that's saying to America there must be a revolution of values, forcing America to review its values.
You know, I think Dr. King could just, if he was at K-State in 2016, he could give that same speech again, get the same standing ovation.
That's Dan Likens, a lawyer in Topeka, and the most Kansas guy that I know. We talked to him for our RFK archiver, and he was the one who told us about the King's speech in 1968. He took some of the photos you'll see on our website. He interviewed King that day for the student radio station.
There's a lot of problems in 2016 that were around in 1968. There haven't been a lot of changes the way we treat people. And I think that would probably, if Dr. King was around today, make him kind of sad to think all these years we're coming back to where we were in the old days. You know, we're just not treating people the way we should in America. I mean, you really were spellbound because you know this is a great man that's speaking to us at Kansas State. And a lot of pictures were taken that day showing, once again, 99% of the people there were white students or white people. And they were all giving him standing ovations. He had nothing that happened that was a negative, that whole talk at Nathan Fieldhouse. It was all positive. And during the interview, I know he told, when one question was asked, you know, what does coming to universities do to you? How does that affect you? And he said, you know, a lot of times I get down in the dumps. I get sad about what's going on in the world. And then I come to places like Kansas State and get a reaction like I got today. He says, just gives me energy. I just feel like I'm going to go out and keep fighting and never give up till we get justice for everyone.
As I mentioned, I wanted to talk more about that, justice postponed and justice for everyone. So I went to Kevin Wilmot, a filmmaker and professor at KU. Kevin grew up in Junction City, just down I-70 from Manhattan, and a man who has dedicated his art to social justice.
It was, on the surface, not a bad place for black people, but the discrimination and the racism was kind of low key. And, you know, I mean, that part of the state never had segregation signs. It never had, you know, whites only, you know, drinking fountains, kind of, you know, that whole thing. That it wasn't part of it. But I remember as a kid, you know, walking down, you know, the street with my mother in Junction City, and there was this, you know, it was I think it was called a Good Eats Cafe. And it had this great smell coming from the place, you know? And I said, man, we should go in there. And she said, no, we don't go in there. And so there was like the kind of discrimination, the kind of segregation that there was kind of, you know, people that had lived there long enough knew kind of where you could go and where you couldn't go. Or, you know, not that you couldn't go in, but you probably wouldn't have been welcomed. You know, you might have been treated poorly, that kind of thing. You know, I always like to tell the story that when I was in fourth grade when King was assassinated, and when the flash came across the TV and my mother started screaming, and she went outside and she was screaming and hollering, my older brother and my father, and there was a man from down the street that was at our house at the time, and they had to pull my mother in the house, and she was just going crazy and crying and screaming and angry. When they finally calmed her down, I turned to my brother and said, who's Dr. King? And that's when I learned about Dr. King. And I went to school the next day, and I was that current events kid, you know, that always talked about, you know, what was going on in the world. And I went to school and I raised my hand and I said, you know, last night Martin Luther King was assassinated. And my teacher said, we won't be talking about that. And I think that had a huge effect on me, because I don't think I've ever stopped talking about it ever since. You know, my film CSA, Confederate States of America, I've always kind of seen, you know, the Civil War as a kind of a measuring stick in terms of how you measure progress in the country. And, you know, that time when King was here, you know, it was clearly was a time when the measuring stick was moving forward. And you felt like, you know, I mean, the fact that he's even in Manhattan tells you something. And the politicians at that time, you know, were far more moderate. And, you know, I'm sure they weren't, you know, necessarily civil rights, you know, pioneers, but they weren't screaming against it, you know. And so that in a whole just gave you, I think, a safer feel for things.
And you don't think it feels safe now?
No, not at all. Not at all. And you know, and because I think what's happened, and the Trump election is the embodiment of it, now becomes the visual kind of, you know, symbol of it. But it's been this way. It's been heading this way for a long time in the state. And it's really kind of disheartening to kind of see the clock go back, you know. And I'm sure the people that are part of that is say, well, that's not how we feel at all. But it's not about how you feel. It's about the actions that have been taken that make people feel insecure. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, again, the measuring stick from Dr. King being in Manhattan, I mean, that made you believe that, you know, the country is going to go toward King's dream, that would maybe become the reality in American life. And everything that's been happening in the last few years, especially in Kansas, has told you that these people really don't believe in that dream, that the leadership, you know, doesn't maybe even understand the dream, that they believe in a different dream. And that's the thing that's so, I think, so frightening to people, that maybe there's another America that is growing right now. And certainly, you know, the president has become the symbol of that. And he talked a lot about that. You know, it's like, when I think of America being great again, I think of, you know, a multicultural America. I think that it is King's dream that is the embodiment and the symbol and the practical reality of what that dream looks like. I don't see that dream right now.
The only new thing in the world is the history I do not know. Harry Truman said that, and his quote kept rolling around through my mind as I read King's K-State speech. Truman, by the way, is a political hero of mine. Why haven't we learned what King tried to teach 48 years ago in Manhattan? Well, really big thinkers have failed to answer that question, and maybe we never will. But I suspect it has something to do with political leadership. So I'll leave you with this final quote from Dr. King's speech. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher of consensus, but a molder of consensus, King told the crowd. On some positions, cowards ask the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic?
Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must take it because conscience tells him it is right.
And that's Archiver. The podcast is produced by Matt Hodapp in the studios of KCUR 89.3 in Kansas City and is made possible by a grant from the Kansas Humanities Council.
Thanks to Sam Zeff, Fountain City Frequency, and Do Good Productions for this story. And now, the story of Richie Restivo, a Kansas City musician who had just graduated from high school when he was killed unexpectedly in a fight. Pretty soon after his death, a friend wrote a song about him, but it took 10 years before he was able to perform it. The Grizzly Hand finally released the song on its most recent album in November. Here's songwriter Jimmy Fitzner and his bandmate, Lauren Crum, talking about The Picture I Keep.
Richie was this really cool, beautiful human being who was a hell of a musician, probably the best musician I ever met, an awesome songwriter. You know, he looked good and he acted right and he cared. He grew up in like playing like ska music, reggae music. You know, so it was that scene, kind of the Kansas City punk rock scene.
I woke up today trying to figure out which part of my brain I keep calling my broken heart.
He was killed in a fight. It was a big group of guys, two groups of people, and they met each other to resolve the differences or fight it out or whatever it was. And there's a lot more guys on one side than the other, and he was jumped and he was stabbed to death. And killed in Rockhurst High School parking lot.
I woke up today and I put on a suit that you would have loved, and I carried your casket into the sunlight. I cried for your mother, I just couldn't mask it. Some people say
I wrote the song pretty quickly, or some of the lines, and the little guitar lick was kind of for him. But then it was just kind of, I don't know, I'm kind of a goofy guy, and there's lots of fun stuff going on, and usually in my songs, I think so, it just got a little too, it was a little too heavy.
Oh, we shelved it. I was like, not ready. I like ugly cried. So then it was like, heard nothing of it for a few years. I think he realized that it was like,
yeah,
it was obviously like incredibly poignant, but I really didn't make it through.
It was like it solidified a bunch of people in amber. It encased our friendship in a weird way that I don't think is possible without something that violent and tragic happening. So hundreds of people that he knew through music or high school or whatever all started to become friends. And then you'd see people that, like, I know you knew Richie. And so then those people started, forming relationships and starting bands and getting married. And these people, I mean, he basically created a little social network with his death in kind of a really weird way.
It's weird when you lose someone that's basically a teenager. Like, we're grown-ups now, so it's different. And the memories that we made with him and the things that we carry are, they don't translate. They're in a box.
We kind of ended up with a band that we needed to have. And it takes a little time to get used to one another and fall into your groove and make something worth hearing. And
a lot of people in the band knew him really well, as well as me or better. And so it was finally kind of time. So that's Richie's primary instrument, was the trumpet. And so that's why it was very important, I think, to bring horns into the song, give it that ska feel. There's sort of a bridge part where the song kind of changes. And we wanted it to turn into that, like turn into a song he would write, or turn into a ska song right there. So you hear the kind of the upstroke on the guitar.
My favorite part of the song that's really important to me, and something that I, when you get old and your friends die, that I think is really important, is the idea that you can talk about it, because it's weird, and then you're the weird person talking about your dead friend. But it's like everyone in this room has a dead friend.
Do you mind if I turn off the radio? Because that song that's playing, the sound that it's making, and that trumpet is breaking my heart. I knew him well, and I think about him all the time. I know you don't mind if I sit here and just talk about him a little while longer.
Sylvia Maria Gross brought us That Story of a Song. The interview for this installment was recorded live at the Buffalo Room in Westport. And that's it for today's show. You can listen back to anything you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Subscribe to our podcast while you're there, and you will never know the pain of missing a great episode. Tomorrow, it's a food show. We'll be talking about pasta with the food critics, and they'll tell us about some of the best new restaurants in town while they're here. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.